From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Thanks so much for being here, everybody. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. This hour, we're going to be joined by Columbia professor Rand Kivitz. He really knows what's going on. He went out of his way to record just about all the uprisings at Columbia. So what is really going on with the encampment? What are they really saying about Israel and about Jews? This is so unacceptable in America. I just can't get my head around it. How pervasive it is, how it's growing constantly, especially here in New York. Professor Ron Kivitz in a little while. I'm going to try to get as many calls as possible this hour because I don't know how much time we're going to have the rest of the show. So 1-866-408-7669. You can get online now. And, of course, I hope to see everybody tomorrow night. And that is Saturday night on the 27th, beginning at 7 o'clock. We'll be in Henderson, Nevada. The History, Liberty, and Laughs tour puts down stakes. It's going to be great. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
Who thinks the number one issue is the economy? Raise your hand.
Yes. I would say inflation.
Definitely the economy. Everything's just too much expense, too much to go eat.
Who do you think is best fit to handle the economy?
Donald Trump.
That is Lawrence Jones, talking about what's happening with our economy. Our growth is down. The GDP is down. Inflation is going up, and interest rates are probably not going to get cut. It's going south. Binomics, a tougher sell by the day. We talk about your wallet and the 2024 election and what it means for it.
Number two.
It was a good day for Donald Trump because there were five justices that clearly were not buying into the D.C. Circuit's approach. Now, that doesn't mean that they're going to say that Trump is immune from prosecution.
That is Jonathan Turley weighing in consistently and constantly, and I always appreciate it. Trump trials, fascinating and impactful debate, and decisions loom for Trump at the Supreme Court as they debate immunity for a president, plus day eight of the clown show in downtown New York City as defense continues to cross-examine David Pecker. What we expect and what the reasons why Trump was pleased yesterday.
Number one.
You see what's happening on the front having to do with Palestine and Israel and protests and hate, anger. Biden is sending an absolutely horrible message.
You talk about chaos. Joe Biden is Captain Chaos. Hamas, Palestine, anti-Semitic takeover of the college campuses only grows. Outside forces behind it, you bet. Iran and Hamas salute it. Unbelievable. Time for action is now. And the president, as usual, is MIA. I do know he's in New York City. He's about to do an appearance on Howard Stern. And when he does it, everything's blocked off here. It's right across the street from us. Howard Stern, who's Jewish, has to bring up the anti-Semitism that is just poisoning this country right now, which is never acceptable. I never thought I'd hear even an epithet thrown out, but now it goes out constantly. And our next guest recorded a lot of it, and you're about to hear it. And don't hold your ears. Pay attention, because it's only going to get worse. And this president can't worry about his election fortunes. He has to do what's right. And what right is this. Hey, guys, anti-Semitism will never work in America. It's never going to be accepted anywhere, my administration or any administration. And for you to do it at Columbia, for you to do it at NYU, for you to do it now at FIT. Are you kidding me? The Fashion Institute? And these are people going around just fomenting unrest. Most of them aren't even students. Money coming from the outside. Praise coming from Hamas. Listen to Iranian's foreign minister. He's upset at our crackdown of Colombian students. The suppression and harsh treatment of the American police and security forces against professors and students protesting the genocide of war crimes of the Israeli regime in various universities in this country is deeply worried and disgusted by the public opinion of the world. The repression is in line with the continuation of Washington's full-fledged support of Israel. Now, keep in mind, this is the same country that cracks down on women for being female, for putting them in jail or killing them because their hijab's not on right. The Hamas spokesman, Bassam Naim, tells Newsweek, "We in Hamas movement believe that any popular movement demanding an end to the aggression and genocide against our people are useful and supportive activities for our case. They also refute the Zionist narrative, the importance of increasing if these activities involve young people and university students, given that it's a reflex of their vision of future generations." So, congratulations, next generation, you enlightened individuals, Hamas loves you. And you could go over there and live with them. They have openings because thankfully 18,000 at least have been killed in Gaza. Here's the President of the United States. Cut one.
Very importantly, as you look at the various colleges all over the country and beyond colleges, because it's happening in other areas too, you see what's happening on the front having to do with Palestine and Israel and protests and hate, anger. Biden is sending an absolutely horrible message. Horrible, horrible message. He has no idea how to message. He can't speak. He can't put two sentences together. He doesn't know what to do. This is not our president. This is somebody that shouldn't be doing what he's doing because he can't do it. He can't do it well.
And he's at war with the New York Times because of it. The president can't speak. You know, he reads verbal cues out of the teleprompter when he says pause. I'll play it for you at a later hour. But the president of the United States being called out, but of all people, the New York Times, because he doesn't give interviews. He doesn't give remarks. He puts out written statements, obviously not written by him. And the New York Times says, if you don't want to interview with us, interview with somebody. How could you not interview with anyone? And what he does is he goes and sits down with different celebrities and does podcasts. Conan O'Brien, very funny guy. And now Howard Stern, very talented guy, who's very Jewish. And talks about who was growing up and being Jewish all the time. I listened to him all the time before I got the morning show. And for him, and I listen to the repeats now because it's his whole channel. And I don't know, for him to not use this opportunity, if he doesn't, to bring up anti-Semitism in this country, and this president brings it up because he also quickly brings up the fact that, you know what, we should understand the Palestinian cause too. The Palestinians have dropped every opportunity to have any type of peace. The administrations have been lost because of it, and people are tired of it. And then comes the October 7th attack, and they got to go through with it. So talk about what's going on with the New York Times. Kind of interesting. New York Times write this. For anyone who understands the role of the free press in a democracy, it should be troubling that President Biden has so actively and effectively avoided questions from independent journalists during his term. The president occupies the most important worldview along the public to assess his record and office in the nation, and the press plays a vital role in providing insights into his thinking, his worldview, allowing the public to access his record and hold him to account. Biden has granted far fewer press conferences and sit-downs and interviews with journalists than virtually all of his predecessors. In meeting with the vice president and other administration officials, the publisher of the Times focused instead on a higher principle. The systematically avoiding interviews and questions for major news organization doesn't just undermine an important norm, it also establishes a dangerous precedent. I agree. It's also an insult. And the New York Times speaks for everyone. Trump would get out of the White House in the middle of the Russia hoax, answer all the ridiculous questions, told his press secretary, you don't have to do this anymore. They're not giving you a chance to speak, so you're done. That was at Stephanie Grisham. And this former president took questions all day and night. More interviews day and night. Sits down with 60 Minutes. Obviously a non-friendly outlet. And now this president sees anti-Semitism cropping up everywhere, sees the controversial foreign aid package pop up everywhere, makes some remarks, walks right away from the press, mumbles half of them. And now he says they're not going to do anything about it. So one thing, when you see the president, you don't see strength. The guy can barely walk. He's got arthritis in his back, whatever it is, broken foot, who knows. So you know what they're doing now? They are now surrounding the president with handlers and Secret Service. So if you see a slow-moving ocean of people, it's because one man's in the middle shuffling along. Nothing wrong with getting older. But if you want to fight people who say you're too old to do the job, don't avoid doing interviews because you're afraid it would prove it. Back to Columbia. Senator Lindsey Graham, cut eight.
If you're a Jewish student in Columbia, you do not feel safe. Come to South Carolina. You will be welcomed. You will be safe. So I find this to be empowering our enemies. They may be motivated in their heart for the right reason, but what they're doing is disgusting. What they're doing is un-American. What they're doing is dangerous. They're being sympathetic to religious Nazis.
couple of things. If you told me, if I have handlers, and he's 83, if you told me I have handlers, say, oh, Mr. President, we've got an election in 6 months, don't come out hard against the students and always bring up the Palestinian cause, I'd say, sorry, there's certain no-go zones. I'm speaking out against those students. I'm calling up that president and say, these Jewish kids don't feel safe in America. You can't do that under my regime. The previous guy I vilified. And, you know, Trump came out and had a great comment. And people think, I saw some guy on CNN retweeted as if it was a ridiculous statement. Here's what Donald Trump said, and I didn't even remember this. He says, compare this to Charlottesville. Cut to.
We're having protests all over. He was talking about Charlottesville. Charlottesville was a little peanut, and it was nothing compared, and the hate wasn't the kind of hate that you have here. This is tremendous hate, and we have a man that can't talk about it because he doesn't understand it. He doesn't understand what's going on with our country. He doesn't understand that all over the world we're being laughed at as a country because of him and his administration.
Okay. He's 100% right. Jim Acosta tweeted out how ridiculous a statement that is. There were some idiots there, some white supremacists. I guess I wasn't there. I was actually on vacation that week at Yellowstone Park without any internet. So I always got to this story late. I always feel like I'm behind on this story. But what Trump was trying to say, and Michael Rappaport, of all people, did some research. And he was just saying, he goes, we were totally fed a wrong narrative. What happened is people wanted to stand up for the statues, the historical statues in South Carolina. They were fighting to keep it up. Some were Confederate soldiers, definitely up for debate, always up for debate. But there were some great Americans who were on the wrong side of it. As Lindsey Graham told me, he goes, he looked up at his Confederate statue when I was doing the shoot on the President Freedom Fighter. And I'm with Tim Scott. And he looks up at the statue of a Confederate war officer. And he said, they were great Americans. They were wrong on this. With Tim Scott there. I go, do you think that? He goes, no, that's part of America's past. This is called a debate. So when the former president said there were good people on both sides, that's what he meant. Not white supremacists or idiots that run over women who happen to be protesting there. So you compare that to riots in University of Texas, Austin, or Rice, MIT, Emerson. Now we find out that Princeton, Brown, USC. Where do we find FIT, NYU, of course, Columbia. University of Pennsylvania is also ramping something up. Harvard now, Yale. You compare all those things with that one day over a course of a couple hours. Of course, Trump's 100% right. And of course, you're all underreacting. I didn't look at the late night shows. I just am too busy. But I guarantee you, no one made fun of anything that comment that Joe Biden made when he actually said pause. He read the stage direction off the prompter. If Trump had done that, they would have led with it. And if there were these anti-Semitic rages on these college campuses and Trump was president, Jimmy Kimmel would have been weeping again during his monologue on what happened to America under this president. Think about this. They talk about Trump being chaotic. Most of the chaos happened with Trump was, yeah, there was some things inexperienced, wrong people. Got it. Understand that about the whole Muslim ban and how it was relayed and implemented. Yes, of course that was wrong. But ultimately, it was the right approach. But ultimately, the implementation was wrong. Got it. But most of this stuff was the Russia hoax. They would plant the story about Russia. He would deny it. Nothing, no questions. All the questions would be about it. Therefore, the press said this is chaos. You got the Interior Secretary on a Sunday show. All they're talking about is the president got elected because the Russians put him there. John Kerry telling stories to French leaders. The president's going to be impeached. You're not going to have to deal with him. If you want to know about the chaos, yeah, Trump was atypical, unorthodox. But it was the Rick Elias, all these stories, the crossfire hurricane that was put in his direction. This president, we're looking at a tumult in the Middle East like I've never seen in my lifetime, that I only read about, happened before my lifetime in 1948, 1967. Number two, you're looking at Eastern Europe, a war. We see a land invaded and a country in full march to absorb another one, first time since the 1940s. And then you look here at home, anti-Semitism out and about, right in everybody's face, where Jewish kids don't feel comfortable going to school. Who is the agent of chaos? Thank you. Brian Kilmeade Show. We're going to be back with your calls in just a moment. I didn't even touch the trials yet. and they're just getting heated up again. I'll be able to get real-time updates. We have reporters in the room, in court, and some in the overflow room that allows them to report. Don't move. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
The Will Cain Show is now dropping 5 episodes a week. Join Fox & Friends weekend host Will Cain as he tackles the latest headlines from his unique perspective, along with thought-provoking interviews with leading figures and live calls from viewers and listeners. Listen wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
He shook his head several times as David Pecker was testifying. It's actually among the most animated we have seen him. It's the kind of reactions that he had during, say, the E. Jean Carroll trial, although he was much more pronounced there in January earlier this year. But this was uncomfortable testimony from David Pecker, walking the jury through a narrative about, engaging with Trump's former personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, about killing stories about Trump's involvement with two women. And in particular, Pecker told stories about engaging with Trump while Trump was president and having a conversation that related to one of these women.
Happened in the past, right? But is this about election interference, change in election? Wow. So many people came up to me and said, if I knew about Kara McDougal, I would never have voted for Trump. That's what we're supposed to believe? I'm trying to get at my head around this case. That's what we're supposed to believe. That was Maggie Haberman, who is an insider with the New York Times and lives off Donald Trump, literally lives off him. I don't know why. I think at one point he was talking to her, not anymore. But just to see the micro reporting on Donald Trump and just to know, does she have another beat? Does she pretend to be fair? Does she ever come out and say, hey, you know what? As salacious as this is, it is 10 years, if not older than that. And I don't know how it figures into election interference, especially because the Russians were the one who threw the election to Donald Trump. Exactly, right? John, you're in California. John, what's on your mind?
Good morning, Brian. How are you doing?
Good.
I have a concern.
Okay.
I think it's the plan of the Democrats all along to get a conviction. Now, once you're convicted and you go through an appeal, even though we know all these charges are BS, what the plan is, they're going to be able to limit, just like if you're on probation. While you're going through the charges, they can limit where you go, who you have to check in, drug test, just like a regular criminal until you go through the process of appeal. I think that's what they're going to do if he gets found guilty in this trial.
I never thought about that, John.
I
will find out about it. I never heard that brought up. I appreciate that point. I never thought between sentencing and if a conviction happens, what changes? Now, is he going to go to jail for this? Everyone says no, first-time offense, a Class E felony. Should he go to jail? Obviously, the case shouldn't even be tried, but I don't want to keep saying that. I'm going to keep moving through the play-by-play of it, but I did not know that. So in 6 weeks, we'll all be focusing on it, but you're ahead of your time. Thank you. When we come back, I'm going to talk to Professor Ron Kivitz, a professor at Columbia, who's been taping all this unrest. You're not going to believe what he has to say.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Sail the line into the middle of the ocean and sink it.
So that's genocide.
Oh, well.
Israel.
That tape is just a little bit the hellacious things going on at Columbia. I imagine it's even worse at NYU. Now it's spread to FIT, the new school, Brown. I could name a prestigious school and some not prestigious, like Emerson. And there's all this anti-Semitic, anti-Israel, pro-Hamas, pro-Palestinian activities going on at a time in which I thought that would instantly get you an FBI investigation. Now it's so pervasive, there's pressure on the police force to leave these people alone, believe it or not. In the case of USC, they've been overwhelmed and had to let go of these heretic students because the police cars were surrounded. And it's only getting worse. Professor Rand Kivitz has been doing it all. He's a professor at Columbia University. He's also got a hold of this tape so everyone could see the reality of these twisted minds and the people that are twisting them at places it really began for me when I became aware of it was at Columbia. Professor, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on air.
Professor, why was it important for you to put together a tape like you did? You sent it to me ahead of time for everyone to see.
Well, I sent it to you because I think everyone should see it. I did not put together the tape. It is actually Columbia University students that took the videotaped and put the tape together. And as you said just now, it is, I think, crucial that everyone see what is going on. A iceberg, to use a cliche, an iceberg that you don't see is very dangerous. Now we're starting to see the tip of the iceberg of what has been going on in many American universities all over the country for decades now, for at least 25 years.
You're in the business school. Were you aware how bad this was getting, that this potentially something like this could happen?
I have to admit that I was aware, and I've seen the undercurrents and the incitement, the methodic, fundamental problems and incitement for decades at Columbia and other universities. So, to that, to some extent, actually, the vile anti-Semitism, frankly, anti-Americanism that we're seeing now in the open air, as painful and as unsafe as it is, it actually has also a benefit that it floats out, it brings out what has been going on for decades. And I think some of us were aware that our students are being incited, not in the business school, I have to say, but in the undergraduate programs, in other programs, they're being incited by a minority of radical professors, a very vocal, very tenacious, I would say, minority of professors that have access to thousands of students and are teaching them to not just hate Jews and Israel. That's the icing on the cake. They are teaching them to hate America.
Where's this come from? I mean, there's an investigation beginning on outside sources and a long-term hope to twist America's next minds. Do you think outside sources are doing this?
I see some reports, folks who are doing research on this, that they're saying there's outside funding, outside direction. I just saw the tweet by the Ayatollah Khamenei from Iran, the dictator of Iran, saying that these rallies and campus encampments and these chants reflect their opinions and their resistance. So it makes you wonder. But I think we need a serious investigation. I think we need a serious bipartisan investigation. I see the legislator taking action. I'm very happy that they're looking to the universities. I think many of us are very happy, but it requires the legislative branch, the executive branch. I think the fourth estate, what you are doing, the media, and professional investigations to look at where is this coming from? Where is it funded? Is it coming from the outside? It sure looks like it.
It does. What's going on in your Columbia campus right now, Professor?
Can you repeat the question? I'm sorry.
What is going on campus right now? The encampment stay, the 48-hour deadline is up. They ripped them up last Thursday, and now the president said that was a mistake to call in the cops. And now we're waiting to find out who's going to take up these tents. When are these encampments going to be uprooted?
I'm not aware that I don't know if she said it was a mistake to bring in the cops or not. She clearly brought them in only for a one-time thing and has not done that again. What's going on campus now is that there's a Senate meeting by faculty and student representatives. I don't think the Senate, the University Senate, represents many of us, but they will potentially censor the Columbia president for bringing the police, as crazy as it sounds, which really brings me to another point that change oftentimes comes from without. It is maybe unrealistic, as painful as it is for me to say, unrealistic to expect a system to reform itself from within. And, you know, the mind that creates a problem, as actually Albert Einstein said, typically cannot solve that problem. This problem, what is very important for me to say, has been going on for decades. You have radical professors, tenured and untenured, teaching thousands of students at Columbia, but also elsewhere, year over year for decades, that America is an evil force, that the American military is an evil force, that America is a colonialist force, that the free market system is wrong and evil. Teaching the Marxist messages that are intended to undo everything that America, the hope of the earth, is standing for. And of course, Israel and the Jews are an easy target for that.
I want you to hear what Ilhan Omar said on your campus yesterday with her daughter, who was suspended and kicked off campus for her unsavory behavior. But I guess it doesn't really matter. Why she's telling why she showed up. Cut four.
I just wanted to see and make sure that that we were hearing from the young people that it is peaceful, that they want the issue to be focused on the demands that they are making, and that, you know, we should not conflate other things that are happening elsewhere to the encampments that are happening on college campuses.
So has she been helpful? Has AOC, has Congresswoman Omar been helpful?
No, not helpful at all. In fact, they're helping to create one of the greatest destructions of brand value in history, a brand that has been created in 270 years, from King's College to Columbia University, a tremendous brand from the founders, now is being tarnished in the last 6 months in a way that will be hard to recover. The problem with Ilhan Omar and AOC, and they do not represent, in my opinion, they do not represent the majority of their party. They do not represent the American people. And actually, they're analogous to these professors. There's 100, 150 professors out of thousands of professors at Columbia that I was referring to earlier, these radical professors. They do not represent the majority. Even the students, which have a right to peaceful protest. This is not what's been going on in Colombia in the last 6 months, but they have a right to a peaceful protest. They're not at fault. They've been brainwashed. But even the students that are in the encampment do not represent the thousands of students at Columbia. So when AOC attacks the police, or when Ilhan Omar says what she says, she doesn't represent the American people. She doesn't represent even her own party. But they're very noisy, and they're creating an environment that is really untenable. I mean, it's hard without seeing the images to believe what's going on there. What's actually going on the last 6 months is people peacefully standing with American and Israeli flags, being harassed, being attacked. People come next to them with yelling at them, "You're Nazis," coming with signs saying, "Qassam missiles, here's your next target. These are the Hamas missiles."
I know.
And people stand peacefully with American and Israeli flags. I mean, it's really beyond.
And what about where they get all these Palestinian garb? You got to be kidding me. Did Yasser Arafat have a fire sale? I mean, they're all told in these sheets to cover their face and show up and spread out. And now, by the way, I'm talking to Columbian professor Rand Kivitz about what's really going on campus. And everybody should know it's even worse than you think. But you see this happening. And now we got these flyers that say, make sure you cover your face. And they got the signs that they hand out. And all the tents seem to be from the same shop. So I want you to hear what President Biden said. He won't address this directly. They put out statements and have spokespeople. Here's one shouted question.
Do you condemn the anti-Semitic protests on college campuses?
I condemn the anti-Semitic protests. That's why I've set up a program to deal with that. I also condemn those who don't understand what's going on with the Palestinians.
Is that a both sides comment?
Look, it was hard to hear what he said. I don't think what's going on campus is pro-Palestinian. I think it is anti-Palestinian. Anyone who's interested in the peace, livelihood, prosperity of the Palestinian people, including people who are interested in their self-definition and so on, doesn't matter what your politics are about that. What is going on now on campuses is not helpful at all to the Palestinians. These are what seems as Iranian, Hezbollah-type philosophies, and even maybe directly funded by them, that will fight to the last blood-blessed Palestinian. It is not helping the folks who are demonstrating, the folks who are stoking the fire at these campuses. Many of them have never been to Israel or Gaza or the West Bank. They don't know anything about what's going on in Palestine. We have videos of some of the students have been incited and brainwashed, and they don't even know why they're there. But I do think this requires a bipartisan approach, both
yes.
by the Congress and by the
executive
branch.
I think you could get it, because I saw Congressman Gottheimer out there, Josh Moskowitz out there. But what I don't see is Senator Schumer. He's the most powerful Jewish American that'll hold that position of authority ever in American history, majority leader of the Senate from New York, and doesn't say a word about it. And it's his responsibility to speak up. Here's more from that tape you sent over from the campus. Listen to this comment about October 7th, the time there was a massacre among innocent people in Israel.
Hey, remember the 7th of October.
Never forget the 7th of October.
That will happen.
Never forget the 7th of October.
One more time. Not 5 more times, not 10 more times, not 100 more times, not 1,000 more times,
yes,
but 10,000 times.
That sentiment, not rare.
No, not rare. They are calling what that video that you played, and again, I really would ask your listeners if they could look at some of the videos, look online, the videos that you're publishing. What they're saying there is we are going to commit an October 7th on you 1,000 times every day. You know, that was 1,200 innocents were killed just that one day out of a population of 7 million. Look, I don't know what everything that Chuck Schumer, that Senator Schumer has said or not said. I do think it would be extremely helpful. I do think he should be very strong in this, speak up. And, you know, he's the senator from New York. And the speaker, I think it'll be very, very important. What is going on in there is not some political arguments. It is not any sort of freedom of speech. It is blatant harassment, discrimination. There's been physical violence. There's been obviously verbal violence. You know, we're in the midst of the Jewish holiday of Passover. And one thing we do in the Passover is we ask, what is different this night from all the other nights? And you can ask yourself, what is different now in the last 6 months, since October 7th, actually, on campuses, on Columbia campus, compared to what's been going on in Columbia for decades? And I can tell you what's not different. The incitement by radical professors that somebody, I mean, it just seems too organized. Who is funding them? Who is directing them? And why is this permitted to go on? This has happened for decades. What is different now in the last 6 months, 6.5 months, is that it has come outside. It has come above, in that sense, it's good, above ground. And it is transformed into real discrimination, harassment, bullying, physical. We have Jewish students that are leaving the university. They've left physically, gone back to be with their parents.
Do you blame them?
No, I don't blame them. Some are trying to transfer out. I'm sure there's a silent majority of students, not Jewish students, the silent majority who are extremely unhappy. They came here to get a world-class education. The professors, the majority of professors, the thousands of professors, including myself, came here not for political activity. We came here to do world-class research. And at the last several months, it is impossible to do that. I don't blame any of the students. I think this is, the grown-ups, no offense, should be blamed for this, not folks who are 18, 19,
I don't agree, Professor. I'm talking to President Rand Kivitz, talking about what he's seeing at Columbia. How many years you've been there?
I've been there almost 25 years.
25 years. I went into college, and I did not qualify for an elite university like Columbia. I knew about the Israel, how it was created. If someone walked up to me and I had some professors, I had a political science minor, that clearly were anti-Israeli, it wouldn't bother me. I know where I stood, but I had the fundamentals down. We all learned the fundamentals in school. Are you saying in primary education we're not learning the fundamentals of the Middle East and the creation of Israel?
I'm saying that in the undergraduate program of Columbia University, you are learning the opposite of the truth. You're learning the inverse, the opposite of the truth. You're learning that professors in core classes, mandatory classes with hundreds of students, this has been going on for decades, are being taught that Hezbollah, a listed terror organization by the United States, is a resistance movement that was formed or encouraged to be formed by Israel. They are learning that the United States of America is a colonialist power that is badly influencing the world, that the American military, and of course the Israeli Defense Forces, are repressive forces. They are learning that the free market is a terrible system.
Professor, keep fighting. I'm up against a break now. I want to have you back on and have you on television, too. We got to spread the word. I'm so glad you're speaking out. Professor Ryan Kivitz, tell us the truth at Columbia, what he's witnessed over the last 25 years and what's happened over the last month. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
You don't think the jury's going to be somewhat offended that this guy who's running for president of the United States is involved all these sleaze balls?
That he buried a sex story, which you heard from their witness. So did this celebrity, so did that celebrity, so did this celebrity, so did that celebrity, so did this celebrity. That it happens all the time. It's not this unique, oh my God, they came out. This isn't Watergate. That's my point. Watergate was a very unique time. It's the first time something like that has ever happened. What came out of cross-examination is this happens all the time.
And that's the beginning of the cross-examination. Arthur Idala on CNN trying to explain to people the unsavory behavior gets you in Page Six and maybe People magazine, but it shouldn't affect you in the presidency. Are you actually thinking, are they actually thinking that these stories suppressed in the National Enquirer allowed President Trump to win the 2016 election? Is that we're trying to find out what the charge is that these stories being spiked allowed President Trump to win the election? Really? As opposed to the story of a Russian hoax leading up to the election that Hillary Clinton commissioned? How about the laptop story that they were colluded to suppress that would have talked about all the deals that Joe Biden was involved in, that his son was involved in, that he called into, and the meetings he had with his business partners and other higher-ups?
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest-growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for being here. I come to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. Heard around the country, around the world. Britt Goldstein is going to be with us. She's a Lawfare Project founder. She's a Jewish student who was booted. A Jewish student who was booted from her academic program at Columbia University is suing the school. She's got that story and that representation. We're going to have hopefully a lot of these Jewish students speaking up and speaking out, getting protection, told to go home, not go to graduation, forget it. They canceled the USC graduation. Also, Darryl Johnston's going to be with us, three-time Super Bowl champ with Cowboys. Also, he's vice president of the United Football League. And he also has a great broadcast with Fox talking about the draft and so much more, including the UFL. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
Who thinks the number one issue is the economy? Raise your hand.
Yes. I would say inflation.
Definitely the economy. Everything's just too much expense, too much to go eat.
Who do you think is best fit to handle the economy?
Donald Trump.
There you go. That is some of the answers Lawrence Jones got. The economy going south. Bidenomics, tougher sell by the day. We talk about your wallet and what 2024 means for you.
Number two.
It was a good day for Donald Trump because there were five justices that clearly were not buying into the D.C. Circuit's approach. Now, that doesn't mean that they're going to say that Trump is immune from prosecution.
That is true, Jonathan Turley, with your incident analysis. Trump trials, fascinating and impactful. Debate and decision looms for Trump at the Supreme Court as they debate immunity, plus day eight of the clown show in downtown New York City as the defense cross-examines David Pecker. And what to expect and the reasons why Trump is pleased.
Number one.
You see what's happening on the front having to do with Palestine and Israel and protests and hate, anger. Biden is sending an absolutely horrible message.
He's sending no message or both sides' message. No joke. Hamas, Palestine, anti-Semitic takeover of college campuses grows. Outside forces behind it, Iran, Hamas, or our enemies. Time for action is now. And the president, as usual, is MIA. Although he is across the street on the Howard Stern show, and you think maybe he'll work his way uptown. You would think. Yesterday, to his credit, he met with the Syracuse widows, these two cops that were slain up in Syracuse University. He did meet up there, then also talked about a chip factory that's opened up thanks to the Inflation Reduction Act. So we'll see about that. So the campus chaos continues. And I think the biggest thing is you got to show leadership and not worry about political fortunes and just come out and just condemn the hate. Don't bring up Islamophobia. Don't bring up Palestinian two-state solution. Nothing to do with this. These people don't know anything to do with this. They're creating unrest. 2 years after a pandemic shut them down in their senior year of high school, they seem intent on shutting down their senior year in college, the ones that went through. Do you know what City College in New York, they're starting with it now? Do you know yesterday they started with Fashion Institute of Technology, I guess, FIT? Fashion. NYU, same thing. All these activists going in telling everybody how to put up a tent and how to become a nuisance to the public and to your campus. Here's Erin McNulty, a college student, and how she feels about how her school has failed her. Cut five.
I think that what we're seeing is not just academia failing. This is truly a betrayal of democracy. The fact that her daughter was suspended the other day and arrested and was in the first place back on campus, but that her mother then came to campus and glorified what is happening shows that she truly doesn't care about our democracy or Jews' rights to education.
That is a Columbia pre-med student. Wants to go to class. Talked to a guy yesterday. Just wants to go to class. I go, you going to go? He's Jewish. He goes, yeah, I'm going. I got 3 weeks left. My parents pay $77,000 a year. I got no scholarship money. I said, where were you in your graduating class? Number five. Got a near perfect SAT score. Most of these people without legacy enrollments, you know, they're the smartest kids in all our classes. And that's why I find it hard to believe in a previous guest, a professor of Columbia I interviewed, said, you know, these kids don't know. That's what they're taught. Really? When I went to college, I didn't know what I know now. Got it. But we all had fundamentals of how Israel was born, the wars that they were in. We were taking tests on that. If there was someone out there talking about Israel being on stolen land and God bless the palace, the PLO and Yasser Arafat, it would have been a scandal. And it kills Democrats. This is one thing that we could have bipartisan outrage on and take action on. And the governor of Pennsylvania asked to be a surrogate for President Biden, who would have been a candidate, I imagine, for president had Biden stepped aside. This is what he said he's finding, because you got Penn State, University of Pennsylvania, a ton of smaller colleges in Pennsylvania, and it's a must-win state. Cut six.
I don't think everyone fully understands. I think most people are truly well-meaning people, and that they think they see an injustice in the world, and they think that they should fight that injustice. And I respect that. However, I think it's also important that, because this is obviously one of the most politicized topics to ever face the media, that it's important for people to remember that before they go and they start a lot of crowds and go do a lot of chants, that they're probably seeing a lot of propaganda, especially my generation. Most people get their news from social media, which isn't exactly reliable. So I feel like it's important that people remember that not everything that they're chanting for, they have a full comprehension of. For example, there was a chant about endorsing Intifada, which was like a violent resistance primarily against Israeli civilians.
Yes, and they're chanting it. Listen to some of the, this is what this professor Ron Kivitz sent us ahead of time. He said, Brian, I didn't edit this together. Students edited it together, but I want you to take a look at it. Listen to this.
Sail the Zionists in the middle of the ocean and sink it.
So that's genocide.
Oh, well.
Israel. Israel's a
sickening. Now at least 33 people detained at Indiana University campus during protests, police say. The police say warned the individuals protesting several times in the afternoon. They removed the structures that they were in. They told them not to do anything anymore. They did. They followed their refusal to comply with the university policy. The group was then advised to leave the area. They didn't, so they were arrested. George Washington University, hundreds of pro-Palestinian demonstrators rally at George GW over at the university yard. including a faculty, staff, and students from the D.C. universities to join it. They all were urged to join a movement of encampments at more than a dozen universities nationwide. About 50 students pitched tents at the U Yard about 5 a.m. Yesterday. So congratulations, George Washington University. I know I should have expected it when you sued to get rid of the name Colonials because you didn't like the way that looked or sounded. USC cancels the main commencement ceremony as hundreds are arrested at the anti-Israeli protest across the campus. And you got to see some of this. USC's as bad as it gets. Half of those arrested at the University of Texas protested were not affiliated with the institution, says the administrators. Remember, they got 55 people arrested the other day. Some 26 were not staff or students. They come in, they'll infiltrate. They give these kids something to do. They give them a focus, but they're so ill-informed. If you are gay, if you are gender fluid, if you want to do anything that you would say would be unorthodox, just keep in mind, they will kill you there. Those people that die in Gaza feel terrible if they're innocent, but their flyers dropped, text messages sent. We got their Israel's got their phone numbers, trying to get rid of them. Some mistakes are made in war, but when you massacre 1,200 people in about 6 hours, you better expect some pretty hard reprisals. Northwestern University students built an encampment on Deering Meadow in the pro-Palestinian protest. Their local news captured video of students setting up tents and creating signs, of course, pro-Palestinian. Gives these kids something to do. You know what I was doing in April? I was so nervous because I was trying to get great grades for my May tests. So we're watching all this and know this, that nothing will change because this president won't speak out. And they are ready for massive demonstrations like 1968 in Chicago. They're going to rip the place up. And Republicans can't be blamed. It's going to be August. David Brooks writes, he's supposedly a conservative writer, more of a moralist these days, an anti-Trumper, said this. In 1968, the clashes between the new left activists and Mayor Richard Daley's cops were an early marker of the differences between the more educated and less educated. They were part of a trend that sent working class voters to the GOP. If there are similar classes in Chicago this August, which there will be, the chaos will reinforce Trump's core law and order message. More on the demonstrations. We'll go to him. Doug Emhoff, the first gentleman, has been talking with Columbia officials. Why don't they make a big deal of that? Because they don't want to alienate those would-be voters, even if they're terrorists. Crazy. When we come back, Brooke Goldstein, on what she's working on now and the outrage that's happening. Then Daryl Johnston, we'll take a break and talk a little bit about what happened with the draft last night and the UFL. Don't move.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
So I actually met a lot of Jewish students that are in the encampment. And I think it is really unfortunate that people don't care about the fact that all Jewish kids should be kept safe and that we should not have to tolerate anti-Semitism or bigotry for all Jewish students, whether they are pro-genocide or anti-genocide.
Right. Yeah, the Jewish students are pro-genocide. Right. Pro-genocide. Unbelievable. That is the poorest excuse for a congresswoman, a woman that really has no interest in being here, just condemning what it's like being here. And that is Uma Omar, congresswoman from Michigan, joining us now to discuss what's going on at the college campus where she was at and where her daughter was kicked off of is Brooke Goldstein, the Lawfare Project founder. Brooke, welcome.
Thank you so much. I just want to correct the record there. We are suing Columbia University. Our client was the one who was discriminated against. Certainly not my daughter. I don't have a daughter.
No, I was talking to Ula Omar's daughter was kicked off campus.
Oh, yes, her daughter. Absolutely. Yeah. Not only was she kicked off, but she was arrested for unlawful trespass. And what is so insane is the glorification of these pro-Hamas protesters.
She's a celebrity now.
Yes, I believe she was featured on Teen Vogue, and the messages that these mainstream media outlets, and I'm just shocked that Teen Vogue would hold her daughter up as some sort of example. She belongs in jail.
And she went back on campus. So, Brooke, you've seen this outrage. You're taking action. Well, who are you suing the school on the behalf of whom?
We are suing the school on behalf of a very brave Jewish student who was discriminated against. She was feeling unsafe on campus. You can see what's going on campus. She was denied accommodations to be able to go to attend classes on Zoom. She was denied that. She was also forced out of her program and targeted because she is Jewish. And Columbia University is just one of the many schools that we are bringing groundbreaking civil rights lawsuits against, because the state of affairs is that there are absolutely no consequences for unlawful discrimination and for Jew hatred on these campuses. Could you imagine if there was a mob encamping at the Columbia Quad calling for the lynching and hanging of gays and black people? Immediately the school would respond and get these people out. And yet, because the target are Jews and we are the oldest, most persecuted minority community in human history, no action is being taken. So we aim to stop that, and that's why we are going to the courts to ensure that the Jewish community's civil rights are protected and that we are guaranteed equal protection under the law.
It's unbelievable that you have to sue to do this, and you're right. But you know who would be calling for the hanging of Jews or gays? It would be Hamas. And that's exactly what these people subscribe to. Do you really believe that most of these students are uneducated? Do you think they know exactly what side they're taking?
Well, they have been miseducated. They have been indoctrinated. Our campuses have been illegally occupied by Islamist theology. It is Islamist phraseology that they are chanting. Death to America. Death to Israel. Death to the Jews. They are supporting Hamas and Iran and Islamic Jihad, as five American hostages are currently being held and tortured by Hamas. This is because radicalization has come to our campuses over the past 10 years. States like Qatar have been importing from the Middle East radicalism. They have been indoctrinating, brainwashing our students. Now they are mobilizing them. And if we don't deal with this as a national security threat, then I'm afraid we might implode from within, because everything that is happening right now is following exactly the playbook of how democracies fall.
Right.
Okay, they go into the schools, they educate the students, they create, mobilize them, they create violence and unrest. They're even busing in and flying in outside agitators. And the next step, obviously, is violence. And we have seen violence on the campuses. One Jewish girl had her eye gouged by a flagpole, the end of a flagpole, by one of these pro-Hamas students. Another Jewish student had his hand broken. What are we waiting for? What is the Biden administration waiting for to call in the National Guard? Where's the congressional investigation following the money? How is this so well organized, so highly coordinated? Where is the FBI investigation into the connections between groups like Wool Palestine and SGP and potentially Islamist designated terrorist groups abroad?
I hear you. I want you to, by the way, it's at City College, these sit-ins, FIT, NYU. Now it's all across the country, Indiana University. Here's what Eden Yadigard had to say on our channel a short time ago about being a Jewish Columbian student. Cut 7.
It's very clear to me and to all the Jewish students on campus that what we're seeing isn't free speech. Freedom of speech does not include freedom to harass nor freedom to intimidate. My friends have been punched. My friends have been hit. My friends have been shoved. Flags have been set on fire on Columbia's campus. I mean, that is not what the First Amendment protects. And, you know, these protesters are calling for Tel Aviv to be burned to the ground, to bomb Tel Aviv. They're calling for an intifada revolution, and then in the same breath calling for a ceasefire. And the hypocrisy is absolutely astounding.
She's 100% right. And that's, you know, it's very well spoken. Most of these kids are. They can't believe it's happening. They say it was all under the surface. Brooke, what is the next step with your lawsuit?
Well, the next step is we go to court and we litigate this. But I hope that we don't have to. The honest truth is that the law is on our side. The truth is on our side. The protesters are violating the student codes. And, you know, our greatest hope is that the universities wake up and they do the right thing. They would do the right thing by any other minority group. They should do the right thing by the Jewish community. And if they don't, we will hold them accountable.
Are you taking these cases on? Are you just representing one student? But if other students want to contact you, could they?
Yes, absolutely. Please go to the lawfareproject.org. Click on Get Help if you are a student. If you are an attorney who would like to donate your hours pro bono, please, you know, sign up for our mailing list as well. We could use all the help that we can get.
All right. Thanks so much, Brooke, for doing this. Brooke Goldstein, appreciate it. And her book is, her project is the Lawfare Project. She is the founder. Thank you very much. When we come back, talk a little football. Darryl Johnson standing by. What happened last night? What were the Atlanta Falcons thinking? We'll discuss it. Brian Kilmeade, Joe, so glad you're here.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
With the first pick in the 2024 NFL Draft, the Chicago Bears select Caleb Williams, quarterback, Southern California.
About 100,000 people showed up, maybe more, in Detroit just to see the spectacle, which has become the draft. It's amazing. In some leagues, the drafts aren't even televised. The NFL used to just be in New York, and they said, let's move this thing around a little. It's been one of the smartest moves ever. Before the whole thing started, you saw some of the standouts from this Lions team. The crowd loved it. And then you saw some of the legendary Lions, and, of course, you had Megatron, and then you had Barry Sanders. So you really gave a sense of what Detroit was like, what it meant for them. Also, it helps that the Lions are promising for the first time in my lifetime. Darryl Johnson, former NFL fullback, outstanding player, three-time Super Bowl champ. Now he's one of the finest broadcasters at Fox Sports and also one of the guys in charge of the United Football League, the brand new UFO, which is the result of the USFL and XFL merging. Darryl, welcome back.
Brian, how have you been?
Good. I mean, did you have time to watch the draft last night?
I did catch a little bit of it. Not the entire draft, but definitely moved back at the house for Dallas to watch them move back. But caught the very beginning as well. So I was probably in there right until the big Michael Penix pick that kind of shook up the first round a little bit.
Right. So if you go out and you have a quarterback in Kirk Cousins and spend $180 million on him, does it surprise you? You also select one of the best quarterbacks in the draft?
Well, I think with the injury that Kirk had, you're always going to have a little bit of concern there. But, I mean, you did your due diligence during the free agency process. So it's a four-year deal, but it's 2 years guaranteed. So there's a lot of things that you can look at and try to figure out exactly what Atlanta is thinking. But you're starting to hear a little bit of frustration from Kirk because, you know, why would you bring me here and then bring my same position here in the first round as opposed to bringing in somebody that can help us win. But he's got a lot of good weapons around him already. You know, Atlanta has gone, you know, offense in the last three drafts, very, very high, top 10 picks, running back, wide receiver, tight end. So he's got a lot of weapons around him that he's going to be able to use.
So Darryl, there was a formula outside Dan Marino that you could never start out of college. It's too much to learn. And Marino stepped in college and all of a sudden he was great right away. And that was rare. And now you spend so much money on these guys. They almost have to start within a few weeks. What changed? I mean, it seems like the offenses get more complicated. Why did people lose patience?
I think if you go back and you look at it, you're going to see examples where a quarterback sits behind an established starter for a year, year and a half, and then gets the reins and goes off and has a great career. I mean, obviously the easiest one and the most recent one is Patrick Mahomes. So we've seen it done both ways. But when you talk to the quarterbacks, you know, the quarterbacks always want to be out on the field. They don't want to learn from film review. They want to be able to be out on the field and see it in real time and get adjusted to the increase in the pace of play and the increase in the talent across the board defensively. So it's a big jump from college to the NFL when you talk about the athleticism on the field. And what the window was in college is not the same in the NFL. So there's definitely an adjustment period that the quarterbacks have to go through, and they'd like to get that done sooner rather than later. So I don't know exactly when we've started to see, whether it's, like you said, based on finances, because there is so much money invested in them. I think you have that window you need to find out, because we've seen a lot of them drafted very, very high that haven't panned out to be that quarterback that the team hoped they would be. So I think there's a number of things there, but I think the fact that the college game is pushing up so much of the offensive style of play now in the NFL, it's a much easier transition for the college quarterback to move into that NFL offense.
So interesting. So Darryl, what has it been like, the merger, now that the UFL, you guys are all on the same page, no more rival leagues, no more two spring leagues, USFL gone, XFL gone, UFL is now in. What has it done for the talent level on the eight teams?
Oh my gosh. I mean, that's the biggest thing. It went from, you know, two 8-team leagues to one 8-team league. So obviously you think about the number of players that encompasses. You know, you took a league and basically reduced it by 50%. So now you've got competition at all those positions. And I think the big thing that we've seen, you know, and this is from day one when the guys came in for onboarding, is the body type is very different than what we've seen in spring football. We had a lot of competition during the course of training camp where, you know, players who were starters, you know, last season are now backups, or some guys not even on the roster anymore. You know, they're not in the UFL family at this time. So that shows you, you know, the depth of talent and the quality of talent that was in the league, that because of the attrition, is now elevated that across all eight teams in the league. And I think we've seen that play out here through the first 4 weeks of the season. The games are very competitive. We're starting to see the offenses finally start to catch up to the defenses. Although last week, you know, our trend through the first 3 weeks was an increase in total points per game. And then last week, for the first time, we had a little bit of a dip. So I think the defense has flexed their muscles a little bit in week four.
Right. So you have San Antonio against Arlington. That'll be Saturday. That's this Saturday, 7 p.m. Eastern time at Choctaw Stadium. It'll be on Fox. Birmingham Stallions against the Houston Roughnecks. That'll be 7 o'clock in Houston at Rice Stadium. That'll be Fox Sports on and Sirius XM. The Battlehawks, which are doing great in attendance too, right? D.C. Defenders, that'll be a Sunday afternoon game at 12. That's at Audi Field. ESPN's going to be covering that. ESPN Extra and Sirius. And then Michigan Panthers against the Memphis Showboats, that'll be Sunday. That'll be 3 o'clock at Simmons Field, Simmons Bank Liberty Field on Fox too. How great is it to know that ESPN and Fox are carrying the highlights? Both companies are in.
It's great. It really does help. And we had it a little bit last year with the legacy USFL when we had Fox and NBC as our partners. You know, two really, really good networks at producing professional football. You know, that's kind of right in their wheelhouse, especially when you talk about Fox. So the thing that we've enjoyed, and we have it again with ESPN this year, is how they push the envelope. Because we allow them, you know, in our league, we grant them access that they don't have in the NFL. So we're able to take the viewer into certain areas, whether it's, you know, interviews on the field, eavesdropping on conversations as they're working on their iPads, the play calling scenarios from the offensive or defensive play caller, whether he's in the booth or on the sideline, to be able to dip into Mike Pereira and Dean Blandino in the command center and listen to them kind of sort through, you know, what they're thinking in regards to challenges or actually overturning a play. So to have two partners that will take that access and then really start to press that and maximize it has been great for our viewers.
Darryl, what about the respect it shows when the NFL took your kickoff rule?
it caused a little bit of a conundrum, though, Brian. You know, when they went with the XFL version of the kickoff, we were in the process of transitioning to the USFL style of the kickoff. You know, we had looked at the medical data, and, you know, the big reason, and if you watched the draft last night and you got to see some of the conversation beforehand with Roger Goodell, they actually talked about the kickoff. And it's really trying to bring the kickoff back, but maintaining, you know, the low injury percentages on that play. It's a very dangerous play because of the high speeds and the size of the impacts that you're having. But the way that we do it, we've made our kickoff more like a punt.
I think Daryl just dropped off for a second.
Version that the NFL adopted. So we'll see. You know, we wanted a more traditional style kickoff. You know, we didn't want the staging area. We wanted them, you know, near where the ball is being kicked off. There's just certain things. I love the kickoff play. I mean, I grew up, you know, Billy White Shoes Johnson. I mean, that was one of the most exciting, if not the most exciting play. You know, we just saw Devin Hester.
Yeah.
And Devin Hester went into the Hall of Fame because of his return skills. And so I've always loved the play. I get the violence of the play and the danger, because I was a center on kickoff return, and I had to block R5 and L5, which are usually your biggest guys on the coverage team. So I get how physical that play can be, but I think there's ways around it to make it safer without making that really big step that the NFL did this season. And let's see if we can do a gradual process and maintain a more traditional style. And that's what we try to do with the UFL.
Yeah, I think my son was in on, when he was at the XFL, on the creation of that. So it's pretty amazing to think that the NFL's that open. Do you think, and I want to get you on Reggie Bush too, because with that big move, get his Heisman Trophy back. But I do want to ask you this. Do you think he's going to be far off? Does it work to your advantage to have a direct affiliation with the NFL, where maybe the Cowboys have a team that they could put their players who they want to grow at with you guys, and same thing with different NFL teams where they could bring guys up and train guys?
I think the collaboration component is going to be something that's important, and I think it will benefit both leagues. But, you know, we always stay by our core statements that we kind of put out there when we started in Legacy USFL, and we didn't want to be considered a developmental league. We wanted to be considered a standalone professional football league that plays their games in the springtime. Do we understand the developmental component and, you know, what opportunities we can create? Absolutely. But that's not how we want to view what we're doing in the USL.
Exactly.
You know, we want to be that league that is creating really, really good football for that football fan that wants it year round. And we've seen that with the NFL, the way they have extended their calendar, you know, all the way through the course of a calendar year. You know, you just mentioned, you know, over 100,000 people in Detroit last night, and how big that draft has become as they move it from city to city across the country. And they continue to just push things out and make big events during the course of the calendar year. You know, two more games on Christmas this year on a Wednesday. I think it's Christmas is on a Wednesday, and they're going two games on a Wednesday. You know, that shows the NFL is being very, very aggressive and how they're extending that calendar. And, you know, there's a void there in the springtime, and, you know, it kind of slots right into what we're doing. So we really kind of look at ourselves as, yeah, we've got a developmental component, and we create opportunity for guys to get back to the NFL. But we're really a standalone professional football league for that football junkie that just can't get enough of football during the course of the year.
So one of the things that just popped up is Reggie Bush had his Heisman Trophy taken away years ago because he had a deal with a marketing company. He didn't go with that marketing company. They kind of turned him in. They took it away. They just gave it back. Here's Reggie Bush talking about what it means to him. Cut 43.
What was it like to hold that for the first time after all these years?
It was as heavy as I remember. The first thing I did was pick it up. And I was like, yep, it's still heavy.
This fight that you've been fighting for so long, what emotion came up through you?
You know what? I think when you've manifested this for so long, right, and you've been, I think, through the ups and the downs for so many years, I've cried over it. I have, you know, but I feel like at this point I was just taking it in and just being happy and just enjoying the moment. And just knowing that we did this.
So he got it back, and he went on to say, they said the game has changed so much, but here's what he went on to say, how bad it got. Cut 45.
When I think I'm at my weakest point, and when I'm dealing with depression, fighting thoughts of suicide, there's an entire city there to embrace me and to lift me up and to give me an opportunity to go out once again to prove myself.
He was talking about going to New Orleans and how it had to get him out. Did you know all that was going on with him? And what kind of player did you look him at as? He was pretty dynamic, but he never became the Hall of Famer.
You know, I think he's one of those guys, and we hear this a lot, about timing and circumstance in the NFL. And Reggie Bush, the skill set that he had coming out in today's game, oh, my gosh. I mean, it's become a game that's played on the outside, in the perimeter, getting the football into the hands of the guys in space that have unique separation skills. And then they can also go into the backfield and be a very effective between the tackle runner. And that's what Reggie Bush was. And back then, you know, they were trying. They were trying to find that way to get him spread out and, you know, to really try to stress defenses because he could play so many different positions. I think in today's game, he would be such a challenging matchup.
What do you think about
it? It's kind of one of those timing things.
Were you surprised with the Heisman meant to him? And in retrospect, they said the game has changed so much, we don't have rationalization to keep it away?
We don't have what?
Rationalization to keep the Heisman Trophy away, because that marketing deal be something that would be expected today. Why do we punish him because he was born in the wrong decade?
Exactly. It's long overdue. And obviously with NIL and everything that's going on in the college landscape, it's very hypocritical. The circumstances that was taken from Reggie, but I'm going to be one of those people that feels it should have been given to him a long time ago anyways, or maybe a little bit deeper dive into exactly what the circumstances was surrounding that and maybe not taken away at all. You know, that is the award, especially back then. You know, the college game has grown with the award ceremonies at the end of the season. But at that time, there was nothing bigger than the Heisman Trophy in the college game, and still today. It's a shame that it's been that long that he's had to wait to get that back, because it's long overdue. And there's some people that say it probably should have never happened. You know, the college game has made money off the players, you know, not just in football and basketball, but across the board. And you know, it's something that they've tried to figure out for years and they haven't been able to. And I still don't think NIL is the way to go either. It's ruining college athletics.
It absolutely is destroying the sport. So staying longer, using the portal as free agency. No one's talking about school. Darryl Johnson, thanks so much. Congratulations on the merger. And you do wear many hats. Outstanding broadcaster, fantastic athlete, and a great administrator leading this league. Darryl, thank you.
Great to catch up with you, Brian. Take care.
All right, back in a moment.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, just before we close out this hour, just want to hope to see everybody in person. If you're thinking about traveling to Las Vegas or you're going, make sure you drop by tomorrow night, 27 Henderson, Henderson, Nevada. Show starts at 7, VIP at 5. It's going to be history, liberty, and laughs. Have a chance to talk about history. Also, motivational, inspirational. It is live. Every show is different. There's going to be a Fox Nation component to it. They're sponsoring it, so everyone who shows up gets 6 months free at the world's best. It's really a whole channel. There's so much going on. You got live stuff. You got tape stuff. You have What Made America Great, as I got my series on there, too. So you just go to BrianKilmeade.com, and it's all right there. I'm also going to be in Indianapolis in June, and in East Stroudsburg in July. So VIP opportunities there. And the VIP, I got a chance to talk to you, get your questions, also sign the books, personalize it, take pictures. And the last one is Teddy and Booker T. If you're not in the area and you want a great history book or a Mother's Day present, if your mom's passionate about history, just go to BrianKilmeade.com. It'll go to a local bookstore. They call me up when I have a certain amount of orders. I'll go down there, we'll personalize them, and they send them out. So keep it here. Brian Kilmeade Show.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Thanks so much for being here, everybody. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. It's been a fantastic, really a breakneck piece in week in terms of things happening, developing. And we're looking at the Supreme Court. We're looking at what's happening locally. We're seeing the unrest that's happening in every college. Now it's spread to City College, even though they're on spring break, which goes to show you this anti-Semitism, pro-Hamas, pro-Palestinian attitude. It goes to show you this isn't student-generated, in my view. And we hear a lot from Columbia, but it's really spread everywhere. NYU is a travesty. I was just looking at a video before of a New York NYPD police chief had to run, be escorted into a building because students were coming after him and they were surrounding him. USC, they arrested one of these lunatic kids or a guy pretending to be a student. They surround the police car, and ultimately the cops had to let the guy go. That's how crazy it's getting on college campuses. And that's just one of the other stories. We're also talking about the trials everywhere, as well as the economy. The president got some bad news on the economy, growing 1.4%. No longer can honestly say. He keeps telling everybody we're growing better than any other country in the world, and it's not the case. You have India growing faster. China beating us last month. You also have Turkey, believe it or not, doing better than us in terms of overall growth. Back to the Trump trials. We have people in the overflow room able to type things up, send things out. We don't have a transcript during the day, during this time. We understand the cross-examination's taking place on David Pecker. Tim Pallitori joins us now, former Trump attorney, founder, managing partner of Pallitori Law Group, and joins us. Hey, Tim.
Hey, good morning.
Hey, Tim. I know you've been on CNN, and I know you watch our channel. You're probably like me. You float around. You want to see what everyone's saying. Did Trump have reason to be pleased yesterday after the New York trial?
I think he did. I mean, I think that David Pecker is actually a pretty good witness for him. You know, he laid out this story that can be seen as unseemly, maybe amoral, but not illegal. And the one question that kind of grated on me a little bit was when the prosecutor said, "Did you know that was illegal to do this?" And he said, "No, but do you know now?" Yes, I do. The only reason he thinks it's illegal now is because that's what the prosecutor told him. It's what we're talking about here is not illegal. These types of catch and kill things, whether you like them or not, they're not a crime. And when a media company does that type of thing, under Citizens United, the Supreme Court said that's not a campaign finance violation. So it's problematic for them because they've spent all this time talking about something that's not a crime. And then ironically, right in the middle of that, the Court of Appeals for the State of New York comes down with the Harvey Weinstein decision that specifically says putting in too many of these so-called prior bad acts of uncharged misconduct overturns a conviction. And I think that decision actually could seriously affect the Trump case because it potentially invalidates a lot of what David Pecker has already talked about. That's going to get a great day.
It's interesting. So David Pecker, at the end of it, he goes, "You consider Donald Trump your friend?" He goes, "Yeah." And when Donald Trump was asked from one of our reporters that morning, he goes, "Oh, I like David." So if he was blowing up Trump, Trump didn't pick up on it, nor did his attorneys. So if your defense, if you're working for Trump on defense at this point, you heard what Pecker said. What's your goal today when it comes to David Pecker? Number one, it was clear yesterday on an objection when they said, "Did you know that Trump was aware of this deal with one of these women?" He goes, "I assume." And they just said, "Objection. You can't assume."
Right.
So
correct.
Michael Cohen was not checking with Trump on every single thing. Is that important?
I think it is very important. I mean, one thing that I've personally seen is that people around President Trump, they like to say, "Oh, the boss wants this. The boss says that." And oftentimes he doesn't. He's not involved at all. They're just using his name to get what they want. And, Michael Cohen, I'm sure, has done that plenty of times. And so if David Pecker can't tie Trump directly to it, what I would do if I were cross-examining him is, first of all, I'd make a very friendly cross. I'm not trying to destroy his credibility at all. Very different from Michael Cohen. I would first draw the distinctions of what he doesn't know. Okay, he doesn't know whether Trump was personally involved. He doesn't have that direct knowledge. He doesn't know anything about the payments to Stormy Daniels and how that was repaid to Michael Cohen. He has no idea about what they did with the business records of the Trump Organization. and basically first separate out his knowledge completely from what the actual charged alleged crimes are in this case, then go back and do what they've already started to do, which is to show that all of this stuff is normal. You know, again, whether you like it or not, putting out false stories about your political opponents is normal. I can think of a campaign that spent millions of dollars having a British spy write up a dossier that said Russia had a P-tape of Trump during this exact same period of time. I can think of another campaign that had 51 former intelligence officers put out a fake letter claiming that the Hunter Biden laptop was Russian disinformation so that they could suppress negative stories about their preferred candidate. This is not something that is exclusive to the Trump campaign. It's something that's been going on for years. Honestly, it's been going on since, I mean, aside from, you know, George Washington's campaign, it's been going on since the beginning with, you know, even with Thomas Jefferson's campaign. So it's nothing new, but it's new to these jurors. And so they need to be educated on all of that background. But I don't think David Pecker is a bad witness at all for Donald Trump.
Well, what they're trying to do, so for example, it's got to go from this conversation, the panels that you're on, and it's got to resonate with the jury. And I think sometimes people forget that, is that you have this educated way of looking at the law, and we are able to ask you questions. But when the jury comes back, besides those two lawyers on the jury, they interpret what they interpret. So it's up to the defense to say, unsavory, but not illegal. Right. What they're doing, a distraction should not factor into the case. Whether they spoke or not, or who, not a matter. What I walked away from after I listened to the rundown and look at the synapses, the summaries of the day, is I think they're trying to say that because what Donald Trump did with David Pecker and Michael Cohen, that's the reason he won the election. And I'm going, is that really, really what they want people to believe? Is that really what they're saying?
That's insane. I mean, find me a single voter who said, I was going to vote for Ted Cruz, but then I read in the National Enquirer that his father participated in the assassination of Kennedy, and because of that, I decided to vote for Donald Trump instead. No.
Right.
Find me one person that said, you know, I voted for Donald Trump, but if I had heard that he had a consensual relationship with Karen McDougal or Stormy Daniels, then I would have voted for Hillary. And honestly, we're talking about the National Enquirer here. Right. I mean, my God. The reality is National Enquirer's credibility, they could have run the stories about Stormy and everything, and people probably would have given it less credibility because of where it was published.
So you see, Tim, you and I are talking here. I feel like we're having lunch talking about the case. Yeah. But just in terms of what matters, when I actually go in that, if I'm in that room and I'm looking at that jury, I agree with everything you said. But that jury's hearing, that's the reason why that's what I think they're building. The reason why they won is because Donald Trump worked with Michael Cohen and David Pecker and whoever said they troll out to undermine an election and deny people the truth about the candidate. And one thing they keep saying, what they want to know, too, is about did Donald Trump care if this was about his family or did he care if this was about his campaign? And Pecker says, well, the beginning was about his family, and then it was about his campaign. Those things seem easy for a defense counsel to counter, but important to bring up. So people don't start thinking that's the narrative they want. So your defense, you hear Pecker say, I don't remember him bringing up Melania and Karen McDougal. So what do you say?
Well, first of all, if they are able to properly cross-examine Michael Cohen and call, say, Bob Costello, they're going to find out that when Michael Cohen's offices were first raided and he was given the opportunity to cooperate against Donald Trump, he said, I don't have anything against him. He didn't know about all this stuff. I did a lot of it without his knowledge because I didn't want Melania to find out. So, you know, so there is that evidence there. Remember, that's exactly the defense that John Edwards used where he was acquitted of, you know, very similar allegations prosecuted by Jack Smith, failed prosecution by Jack Smith. And so, you know, that's important. But here's the other thing is the prosecutor said this the other day. This was a conspiracy to influence the election. That is not a crime. conspiracy to influence the election is not in any criminal statute. In fact, I would say to you, conspiracy to influence an election is the textbook definition of a campaign.
Yes.
Two or more individuals who get together to agree to try to influence voters to vote for their candidate. That's different from conspiracy to obstruct an election, conspiracy to interfere with an election. But conspiracy to influence an election, which is the words that this district attorney is using, is not a crime.
Gotcha. So, Tim, lastly, those two lawyers don't look happy. Is it because of the stress of being there? Is it because Donald Trump puts a lot of stress on them?
You know, this is it's definitely a stressful experience when you try a case like this. And, you know, the more scrutiny there is on the case, if you're not used to that type of work, it can be grating on you. I mean,
okay.
I've tried big media cases. I usually enjoy that, but
right.
I could see where they've got a lot of pressure on them.
Tim Pelletori, let's see what happens. We had a few more weeks of this. Tim, thank you.
All right, thank you.
All right, when we come back, Bobby Gunn and Staten Bonner. They have co-authored a book together called Bare Knuckle. Bobby Gunn Jr., 73-0, undefeated. Talk about what has happened since he was fighting in the back roads and the back alleys in bare knuckle boxing. You're going to love this story. Don't move.
This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Who owns Combat Sports now? The King of Violence!
That is a little of the bare knuckle boxing that is now out. And Knuckle Mania is this Saturday, April 27th. It's at the Peacock Theater, the first time it's in Los Angeles. And it's the biggest fight card ever. And the original and the legend there, maybe the greatest ever, Bobby Gunn Jr., is the undefeated bare knuckle champion. He's got a book out now. Had a chance to meet him and his co-author, Staten Bonner, last week. It's called Bare Knuckle, Bobby Gunn, Undefeated, A Dad, A Dream, A Fight Like You've Never Seen. Bobby and Staten, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you for having me on.
Hey, so Bobby, what has it been like talking about your story, Bobby?
It's been incredible. Thank you, Brian, again, for having me on. And just telling people, you know, they're in shock. They can't believe that, you know, it's like I come out of a comic book to them. But it's a story that I hope it'll touch somebody and it can enlighten them on the sport. Because it's here. Now it's legit.
And now you're hearing about Knuckle Mania. Will you be there tomorrow?
Yes. I'm going to be there tomorrow. I'll probably be doing some commentating. You know, I was at the yesterday, like a little press conference they had. I was overwhelmed with people coming up to me. And you know, the legend, the champ is here. And the fighters are treating me so nice. All my work I've done made me sort of pay off.
Staten, when you're writing this book, not many people outside the bare knuckle boxing world or the boxing world knew Bobby. Are you finding he's going mainstream now?
Brian, in my 20 years as a journalist, it's the most amazing story I've come across. Bare knuckle boxing has gone from three events in 2018 to 42 events this year in 20 states and 9 countries. $500,000 in revenue in 2018. As of this month, it's valued at $411 million. It all starts, as we talk about in my book, Bare Knuckle, with Bobby Gunn. You know, Bobby Gunn, it's not a boxing story. It's a human story. He's the closest I've ever come to a real-life Rocky underdog. He overcame incredible hardship under an abusive father who, when he was 11 years old, would pit him against grown men in parking lots fighting for cash. Bobby always took him down. And then he went on, to fight for his family. He never got his due as a pro boxer, started fighting in these underground mob-backed matches for cash to give his daughter a better life. When I first met him, I went with him and saw him drop his daughter off at school. He came back. He told me, look, I'm not scared about these fights I go into. I'm most scared about my daughter being judged by her friends and her friends' parents for what I do. He's just an incredible champion and has helped bring this sport back to life.
Bobby, what kind of talent is in this league, this bare knuckle boxing league?
You got some good, real good fighters out there. Unfortunately, I don't think a lot of them really do the old art that I was taught, Brian. It's like, you don't see the real bare knuckle fighting art. A lot of them really need to be trained to the real bare knuckle. Maybe sometime I can maybe help these fighters do something better to perfect their art. But there's some great competition and some great athletes right now today. I do see that.
I mean, for example, if you're a great boxer, doesn't mean you're going to be a great bare knuckle boxer, right? I mean, there's a way to punch where you don't break your hand.
100%, Brian. Different ballgame. People don't understand. It's like bare knuckle boxing, but it's not boxing. It's a whole different world. It's precision, the right punches, the right way, rolling, like slipping, sliding, different kind of boxing. Combinations you don't do like boxing. One shot can end it all.
Right. Staten, do people understand who Bobby Gunn is in that world?
Absolutely. He's a total legend. It's been amazing seeing Mike Perry, all these brand name guys come up. It's like the legend walks in. I mean, everybody wanted pictures with Bobby. Everybody wanted him to show them his training techniques. And as we cover in the book, Bare Knuckle, Gunn has this legendary repository of knowledge on the sport that he forged in decades. His father grew him up to be a weapon, taught him how to take pain, would wrap a baseball bat with foam and duct tape, hit him in the midsection to harden his abs, taught him, how to hit a wooden floor repeatedly to harden his knuckles. Bobby Gunn, his years as a boxer, he was so good, he had the scientific knowledge, and he has a surgeon's knowledge of a body. So if he's in a bare knuckle fight, he can target his shot. And it's really all of that was due to training from his father. Again, waking him up in the night, coming home drunk, having him fight grown men. And Bobby always tried to win his father's affection or approval. That's really been the lifelong battle of his life. But it's an incredible knowledge of the sport as we go into in the book.
And Bobby, lastly, you want everyone to do your type of push-up on your fists, just below your shoulders. That's what you do to train, right?
That's all I do. And by doing that, also balances your forearms and it pushes your biceps. You're getting a full workout that way.
So, Bobby, if I start doing this now, could I go pro in this league?
So Brian, listen, you dropped me when I was in your studio. I don't want to do that.
Can you imagine that?
Oh, my gosh. Brian, yeah. I'll be in your corner. I'll be in your corner, okay?
Hey, if you're in my corner, I know I'll win. Pick up the book, Bare Knuckle, and check out the fight. It's going to be tomorrow night, April 27th, at the Peacock Theater. Where can we watch it?
It's on Bare Knuckle, their app, on pay-per-view on their app. So everyone go to Bare Knuckle Fighting Championship or come out here to Los Angeles downtown.
All right. Guys, thanks so much. Congratulations on the book. Bobby, you picked a great writer. Good job. And thanks for living a great American story.
Thank you, Mr. Brian. God bless everybody out there in America. Thank you, Brian.
You got it. And the toughest guy is also the nicest guy. It shows you, when these guys act tough, they're usually not. The nicest guys are usually the ones that'll kill you.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Demonstrations themselves are not something that we, the FBI, get involved in. But when violence ensues, that's when we get concerned. When you have threats of violence.
Are you actively monitoring these protests?
We don't monitor protests, but we do share intelligence about specific threats of violence.
You got to wonder where this money came from with all these signs and these tents and these organizations and the communications and the unrest and the spread out throughout these campuses, Indiana University, USC, you're talking about MIT, Columbia, NYU, now the FIT. Where's this all start? What is the message? Why are they getting praise from Hamas and the Grand Ayatollah of Iran? Mike Rogers, former Michigan congressman, former chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, former FBI guy, also served in the military, now running for the open U.S. Senate seat in Michigan. Mike Rogers, welcome back.
Hey, Brian. It is great to be back. And the reason they're getting praise from Iran is because Iran is fanning these flames. And chaos is their friend. It's not our friend, but it's their friend for sure.
They don't have a good message. They don't have a good product. What is so attractive to these students?
You know, so here's the biggest problem, and we've seen this before. So Tehran was getting better at information operations, and so saw a huge uptick in activity from Iranian information operations. And some people were like, well, what the heck is that? So they're sending out information that would be favorable to their cause, and they're using social media platforms to do it, including TikTok, by the way. And they can tailor those messages, and this is where they're getting better and better. You know, in the old days, it would be called psychological operations, but it's information operations now. And so they can talk to college campuses. They can talk to they were even using pretty sophisticated information operations on Israel leading up to the Hamas attack. And trying to make sure people felt a little numb about the idea that Hamas would actually attack Israel. And it had an impact. I think it had an effective impact. And so now we know that they're also using information operations, all of our adversaries, by the way, because they love the fact that we are getting twisted in knots for people yelling death to America, and we don't know exactly how to deal with it. I mean, I think you and I know how to deal with it, but you know, I think there's a lot of college campuses that don't know how to deal with it. And so that part of what Iran is doing, and our adversaries are fanning these flames in social media, the algorithms that are written. So if you're looking up, well, what is, I don't even know what Palestine is, let me look it up. Those algorithms are steering, especially younger kids, to sites that only provide information about how great the Palestinian Hamas wing is and why people should be mad about the Israelis trying to catch terrorists who still hold 130 hostages of Israel that were ripped out of the arms of their families, and their kids and families were murdered. I mean, it's just so unbelievable that anybody could be chanting in support of Hamas. And to see the makeup of this. Listen, I'm pretty hard on all this, Brian. I mean, if you're a foreign student at a university screaming death to America, time for you to go home. If you are a student at that university violating every rule they have by, you know, chanting anti-Semitic chants, guess what? No longer welcome at the university. I mean, this is not 1938, and we should not let it become 1938 that ultimately led to the death of 6 million Jews. We need to be pretty tough, and we need to be tough right now.
No, I hear you. We need to be cracking down, and we don't seem to have that. We don't have a president of Columbia University that is going to crack down. In fact, she got censored for even inviting the cops in to begin with. As you see, it spread to FIT, NYU. A police chief had to run for shelter. At USC, you saw police officers getting surrounded. They had to let out the students that they had arrested. So they're being overwhelmed, and they have doing things like canceling graduation because of their students love Hamas, love the Palestinians. So the day the Iran-backed militias, now you have a situation where Iran is, the foreign minister came in support of the students and condemned our police for cracking down. At the same time, we see Iran, this news, it's expanding their public crackdown on women and girls. They are now focusing on escalating, since they have an escalating conflict with Israel, Tehran is using this as an opportunity to crack down on women, giving police expanded powers to enforce conservative dress codes. The new wave of repression appears to be one of the most significant efforts to roll back perceived social gains in the aftermath of the 2022 protest movement. So get this. While the unrest builds and support for them builds in America, they're cracking down on their women there. And a lot of these women, and a lot of them are gay, and women basically don't exist in Iran. And if you're gay, prepare to die. Does anyone get educated on what they're supporting?
No. A friend of mine was telling me the other day, he was at a coffee shop, and somebody had a LGBTQ+ shirt on for Gaza. And he said he went up to this individual and said, hey, I hope you know if you wore that shirt in Gaza, you likely wouldn't survive the day. You know, they throw gays out of tall buildings. And the person said, I don't believe any of that. I mean, that just shows an absolute and utter lack of A, understanding, B, curiosity, and see, it ought to scare the bejesus out of all of us, because no one takes the time to learn the truth. And so therefore they're out chanting, we are Hamas. And these were not all Palestinian kids. These were American kids, probably came from pretty good homes. And they're out there chanting, we are Hamas. And I think one of the requirements should be to watch the footage of what Hamas did to these people. And it's horrific. Some people came out of there, and the press that saw it threw up. I talked to a French commando, spent 25 years in the French commandos, who is now American citizen, said he went and viewed it. And he said, I've seen a lot of things in my life, and I didn't think anything could bother me like that bothered me. My argument is maybe we ought to have some viewings on these college campuses as a part of this so you understand what you are preaching. They just don't. I think they think this is all the fun and games of being a college student, everything, no consequence. We need to start introducing some consequences.
Absolutely. Here's what President Trump said. Cut one.
Very importantly, as you look at the various colleges all over the country and beyond colleges, because it's happening in other areas too, you see what's happening on the front having to do with Palestine and Israel and protests and hate, anger. Biden is sending an absolutely horrible message. Horrible, horrible message. He has no idea how to message. He can't speak. He can't put two sentences together. He doesn't know what to do. This is not our president. This is somebody that shouldn't be doing what he's
doing. Well, I mean, the president doesn't speak to the press. He doesn't speak to interviews. He just did an interview with Howard Stern where I listened to some of it because I'm doing this show at the same time. He just rambles on the same stories, but doesn't answer anything. The president's worried about alienating the pro-Hamas Palestinian wing of the Democratic Party, so he doesn't say anything. How do you handle it, Mike Rogers, in Michigan, when you know those people in Dearborn and other places are more radical than most people on the squad? How do you get their vote?
Yeah, so a couple of things. There's a saying in Dearborn, according to some of the friends I have there, that it is better to be stabbed in the face than stabbed in the back. So they know my position on Israel. They know my position on Hamas. This is a second kind of generation of Muslim Americans who are very entrepreneurial. They care about education. They care about certain cultural issues. They're not real thrilled to have biological men compete against their daughters in sports. And so I think we have a lot to talk about. And what I've been saying is, listen, you know, when this is over, America is pretty interested in trying to make sure that we don't have a problem like this again. They're going to be helpful to Palestine to rebuild, to make sure that they have the ability to secure themselves and take care of themselves. That's a part of America's national security strategy, and it's a good one. And I'm going to be, you know, I'm certainly supportive of that. In the meantime, you know, we have a terrorist problem that Israel has to fix. And by the way, let's talk about the future of your business. Let's talk about the future for your kids to have an America that isn't at each other's throats. You know, one of the reasons you came here is because you couldn't practice Islam in the way you believed Islam should be practiced. The government told you how. And I said, that's the benefit of America. That's why we need to work on the future, your future, in a country that is still has freedom. And we're just going to disagree maybe on the Israeli Hamas issue. So I think there's conversations to be had. We are actually getting groups together to have those conversations. And yeah, that part will be hard. But I still believe if they know who you are and they know what your heart is and they know what your intent is for their actual future here in the United States, I think we can get there.
I want you to hear what President Biden said. Well, ultimately, the economy will be number one with people, especially in Michigan. They took that off the board. They had their governor's race. She did so well because of abortion. It was on there. So you don't have your primary until August, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
All right. So here's what President Biden said about our economy yesterday in Syracuse. Cut 29.
We have the strongest economy in the world. And that's a fact. 15 million new jobs created in 3.5 years. Unemployment hasn't been this low for this long for 50 years. Wages are rising. Instead of importing foreign products, we're exporting them and exporting American jobs. We're exporting American products and creating American jobs. Here in America, where they belong.
Are those the facts how you read them? Is that what people tell you how the economy feels for them?
I think cannibals have eaten his economy. I'm pretty sure that happened. Listen, he's going to run into one big important buzzsaw. You know, he can hire all the fancy Ivy League economists he wants to tell him everything's just fine. It's called the Mominomics here in Michigan. They're paying more for eggs and bread and milk, and they are paying a lot more for gasoline. And those Mominomics are maybe the most important thing going into this election cycle. People are tired of it. They can't make their mortgage payment, their food payments, their car payment, their insurance is going up. Oh, by the way, all these dumb policies are increasing their energy costs. And they got to a place where it's going to be enough is enough. You want to know the real economy? Talk to a mom. That's why I call it Momonomics. They understand the pressure that their household budget is under, and they're getting crushed. I think they're going to be in for a rude awakening. Brian, I talked to this woman, you'll love this, the other day. She said, hey, aren't you in politics? And that could be a loaded question. So I said, well, depends. There's somebody that looks just like me running for office. And she said, okay, I'm going to tell you, I didn't vote for Donald Trump or Republicans in 2016. I didn't vote for Donald Trump or Republicans in 2020. And I went, okay, well, I'm trying to think, okay, how do I extricate myself from the conversation? And she said, wait a minute, you need to ask me what it got me. And I said, okay, what did it get you? She said, it got me the fact that I now have to work two jobs to pay taxes for the one guy that won't work one job. And now I find out I'm paying room and board and a debit card and a phone and health care for illegal immigrants.
Yeah.
And this is a woman who voted twice, now two elections, against all Republicans. She said, I'm telling you what, I will never vote for another Democrat again. Something's changing. And when they run around the country and Biden run around the country saying, oh, everything's great. Don't you understand? You just don't understand. It's great. Well, guess what? Those moms who are trying to manage those budgets know it's not. So, and they are not going to put up with this.
When he talks about bringing back manufacturing back, it's just flat out wrong. He says we're now making it here rather than buying it over there. In January to February of 2024, the U.S. imported $526 billion worth of goods. We actually exported $345 billion. He keeps saying he added jobs. His economy, his jobs is 22 million. Well, he says he's added millions of jobs. Had the economy not lost 22 million jobs because of the pandemic, the president would have only have added job claims of 5.8 million over that time. The claim is not correct when he says about growth. He says there's a whole bunch of countries. He says we're growing faster than any economy in the world. Turkey, China, Indonesia, and India have all had better quarters than us. And also, he says, he's looking at the GDP a full year. There's no one close to us. When it turns out Mexico, Brazil, Turkey, and a few others are exceeding us. So he keeps throwing out these lines. I'm all for cheerleading America, but you can't be inaccurate over and over again.
You know, exactly. And, you know, by the way, his solving of all of this is, well, guess what? We just need to tax jobs in America more. He proposes a higher business tax in America than China has on its businesses, right, who are already trying to win this economic battle with the United States. I mean, it's unbelievable. But I'm telling you, Brian, something's happening. People are starting to get this, and they're starting to tie the fact that their groceries, it's about $1,000 a month. Matter of fact, the most expensive vehicle to operate in Michigan in 2024 is your grocery cart. And people know it. Families know it. Moms know it. And so they can run around and say everything's great and we've created jobs, and those are all just numbers, because people know they're having a hard time at the end of the month making everything work. And so that's what's changing, and I hope they keep saying it. Let them run around and tell them you're just not smart enough to know that I'm helping you, when you know for a fact you're having a hard time making ends meet. I think it's a disaster.
So I know the Republican Party is divided a little bit on this, and we're up against a break, but I want to get you to weigh in. I am glad that we have money to Ukraine. I'm glad we're getting money to Taiwan, and I'm glad we're getting money to Israel. I wish there was some border money in there, absolutely. But I'm glad that – are you one of those who agrees with J.D. Vance it's a bad move, or someone who agrees with Lindsey Graham it's a good move?
Well, I'm probably right in the middle of that somewhere. I do think that the Senate should have put in some money, or not even just money, by the way, for the border. If they just give this administration money, all they're going to do is hire people to process illegals across the border faster. That's not what we need. We need an enforcement mechanism to get President Biden to actually enforce the law on the southern border. I do think you can do two things at once. Listen, my son is a young Navy officer. I served in the Army. He's fourth generation military. I don't want our military engaged anywhere in the world. So that's why you have to have the biggest, baddest military, and you want your allies to be able to defend themselves. I say it's easier to send bullets and missiles than it is sons and daughters, and that's probably a good investment for us.
Go get him. Mike Rogers in the backstretch now, closing in a few months on a primary, then a general election. He wants to be the next senator from Michigan. It's an open seat. Thanks, Mike.
Hey, thanks, Brian. RogersForSenate.com. Come get us.
All right. Back in a moment.
Expanding your knowledge base. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
There's documentation that backs up what the story that Tucker is telling. There were a lot of references to text messages, to emails. And so the fact that Pecker, and those are supposed to speak to Pecker's credibility, the fact that Pecker is saying that he, you know, had this conversation with Trump where Trump was knowledgeable enough about Karen McDougal to ask, you know, how is she doing, I think could end up being significant.
That is Maggie Haberman. Backing up a story that's not a criminal, not a crime. So they're talking to each other about stories that were spiked. Same thing about a laptop story. Remember, 51 intel agents have come out and said that this was classic Russian disinformation. Didn't a presidential candidate named Joe Biden say the same thing, knowing that was flat out wrong, knowing that Hunter Biden's, Bo Biden's sticker was on there that talked about his foundation and that Hunter Biden knew it? He flat out lied about it. Would that election have been different? You bet. But I don't know. Would 2016 have been different? I don't know. The Access Hollywood tape didn't spike the president. Do you really think that these two stories would have changed anything? Arthur Idala, a voice of sanity on CNN, said this, cut 13. Unfortunately, we don't have any time. We're up against it. But he basically said, you could be offended all you want, but you cannot say that something's a crime when it's not because you're offended by it. There's a lot of unseemly things that happen. Arnold Schwarzenegger, Tiger Woods, Mark Wahlberg, all part of that story. See you Saturday night.
I'm Emily Campagno, host of the Fox True Crime Podcast. January 26th, 1988 was a cold and suspiciously quiet night at the Indianapolis Police Department, but the frigid night took a chilling turn with news of a triple homicide. This week, I'm joined by retired Sergeant Judd Green for a look back at this savage case. Available now on Apple, Spotify, and FoxNewsPodcast.com.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.